Jim told me that while one of his things in coming up here today was he had the time to write a song. I'd asked him to write a Return of the Jellicle Guild to the East Coast kind of ditty, or maybe just play something.
Yeah. I want to preface that. Thank you. I want to preface that.
And so that's where I turn this over.
Because, you know, it's like you said, the last one, the Grand Prix, was 1991.
2001.
I'm sorry, 2001. Yeah. Well, I thought 20 a long time ago.
Yeah.
So 8 years ago, let's see, we used to have the meetings in my backyard sometimes over my house. And my oldest daughter would be 15, my youngest one about 15. And basically, I didn't think the material was appropriate sometimes. Little did I know. But, you know, and you don't want to go about good times and bad times, but I just got to make a comment about that because for those of you that don't know, I was divorced. And I'm just going to sum up real quick. Went through some bad times, I think, what that can do to you. And, but the Jellicle Guild was something that really helped me get through it. And then, well, 8 years, then I got actually realized, you know, I still got something much more important, and that was with my kids. And, of course, you know, I'm very lucky to be able to have had my kids with me, grown up with me, and then also to be able to participate in something like this. And now kind of, they say what goes around comes around. And now I'm very fortunate to be back with all you nice people. And I'm going to do the best I can with this song. That being said, I'm just going to do the best I can with this song because I did kind of finish up the lyrics on the porch today waiting for. But he said, I apologize, I was late. I said, it's okay. I was kind of busy. I had a few things to do. Time to build on a guild. Together again. No violence here. Peace and love, flying so high. Peace and love. Fall trees become naked like us. They're shedding their skin. Things become crystal clear. Limbs floating around. Meeting at a new restaurant. It's called Ray's Place Tonight. The price is right. No credit cards here. Steak houses get jealous. Oyster houses, they drown. They drown on every bite. We have pizza and fantastic beer, fantastic wine. Gotta think of another rhyme. Remember the stories, poetry and songs, one by one. And simply put, here to have fun. But the mystery purpose still lies underneath duality of one, like the power of a knife and a sheath, which can exist without the other. Which has more power, my brother? We're all here together, our thoughts as light as a feather, floating round inward and outward, meeting somewhere further onward next time. So everyone, come down to the Jellicle Guild before you drown in your own artistic soup. Art is meant to be shared, like this poem on the stoop. And if it ain't good enough, Oh, fuck off. I'll get Luther. We're all here together, our thoughts as light as a feather, floating inward and outward, beating sometimes further on.
And this is called Find That Machine. But I'll make a comment beforehand in case you're not familiar. Which, whoa, that was a good one. Full body wrestling. There is now the Hadron Collider, which they've built in underneath the mountains in Switzerland and France. Anyhow, it's a super collider whereby they... either protons or ions, they accelerate them. It's a particle accelerator.
Right.
They accelerate them to these incredible speeds,
well,
crash them into each other.
Yeah.
And the theory is that by studying how these collisions occur, they can sort of reproduce the forces that existed at the beginning of the creation of the cosmos.
Hmm.
And doing so, learn a lot about, you know, how long we'll be here if other things don't come into a play or whatever. But anyway, there's a new book. I won't go into it, but there's a new book that a guy who comes into the bookstore wrote.
Nice.
And it's all about that. So I haven't read it yet, but it's all about that particular.
About the beginning
of the project? No, about the Hadron Super Collider. So anyhow, I was just thinking about that, which intrigues me, and I came up with a kind of weird take on it. So this is called Find That Machine.
For a black hole, where were you when I needed?
Okay. Back up in the hills, there's rumor of an old ego collider. A circular tunnel of glacial granite, smooth and quietly cooled. Entrance at the base of a stand of red sumac. Here, protons of selfhood accelerate, smash, and transform in a subterranean merry-go-round until desire and the power to crush it break out in a new particle. You have finally left the building. And now the dart of a bird, crawl of an ant, heavy green toss of oak leaves brushing up against a two blue sky are all amulet, ally, miracle. Every few years, someone stumbles out of these woods, broken grin flashing, sunspots pulsing and flaring within. Every moment now gifted and unnamed, incomprehensible in wonder and woe. The walk to work and the work of love, one and the same, and not yours. Everything stripped away, nothing to hang anything onto. What a relief to not have to care about what you think you would like to have happen.
Payan, everyone has been loved. Everything has been loved. The clothes don't make the man, but the man makes the clothes, sometimes of whole cloth, other times in the wearing of them, wearing them until they thin, till they become a rag, a remnant, a bandana that was once a shirt tail. The loving of it makes it thin, makes it wear, change. It loves into memory, fragment, forgetting in the shuffle into wholeness, capturing its moment in a scene, part of a picture that lives forever, where all parts are like colors in a color wheel spun to white, then out again into any and all colors of the world, more than they were at first. Everyone has been loved. There is a door in the soul that opens like the tomb of Jesus on the third day, that rocks open and leaves an empty space where the wonder is that something has entered the world again after hurt, betrayal, retreat. Everyone has been loved. The lion, they say, has lain down with the lamb, and the lamb has suckled a pup. Once you have been loved, you can never let go. You can hide, but you can't run. If you stand still, it will grab you. A breeze loves the laundry clothes on the line. Not stopping, it moves through them, becomes them, shapes against them, fills them until they are sailing. A hand loves the hand it catches, pulls it, feels the grain of fingerprints. feet love the ground along the pond that moistens against them, curves underfoot. Mothers love the toys of their children, the laughter that tears them, the violence that rounds them. Baskets love what they hold. Bureaus love the bundles of socks and stray mementos, the postcard before the love affair, the rock from the beach, full of promise of something that may or may not ever come. Hope loves uncertainty, lives on it, breathes into it. Everything turns on the love that has claimed it, that streams through it, recalls it. Love means to stay. It stays. It does.
Yes.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
So when we were in Portland, when it was pretty much Raymond and Victor and I, Victor and I don't write, so we kind of got into this thing where we would really search out for these amazing little bits of books that we read, and so that's kind of how I participate and also reading proxy readings for people. But so one of my absolute favorite people in the world is Neil Gaiman. I'm just going to read a part of this because it's a short story, but I want to just read part of it. So this is called October in the Chair. October was in the chair, so it was chilly that evening, and the leaves were red and orange and tumbled from the trees that circled the grove. The 12 of them sat around a campfire roasting huge sausages on sticks, which spat and crackled as the fat dripped onto the burning applewood and drinking fresh apple cider, tangy and tart in their mouths. April took a dainty bite from her sausage, which burst open as she bit into it, spilling hot juice down her chin. "Beshrew and suck order on it," she said. Squat March, sitting next to her, laughed low and dirty and then pulled out a huge, filthy handkerchief. "Here you go," he said. April wiped her chin. "Thanks," she said. "The cursed bag of innards burned me. I'll have a blister there tomorrow." September yawned. "You are such a hypochondriac," he said across the fire, "and such language." He had a pencil-thin mustache and was balding in the front, which made his forehead seem high and wise. "Lay off her," said May. Her dark hair was cropped short against her skull, and she wore sensible boots. She smoked a small brown cigarillo, which smelled heavily of cloves. "She's sensitive." "Oh, please," said September, "spare me." October, conscious of his position in the chair, sipped his apple cider, cleared his throat, and said, "Okay, who wants to begin?" The chair, he sat in, was carved from one large block of oak wood, inlaid with ash, with cedar and cherry wood. The other 11 sat on tree stumps equally spaced above the small bonfire. The tree stumps had been worn smooth and comfortable by years of use. "What about the minutes?" asked January. "We always do minutes when I'm in the chair." "But you aren't in the chair now, are you, dear?" said September, an elegant creature of mock solicitude. "What about the minutes?" repeated January. "You can't ignore them." "Let the little buggers take care of themselves," said April, one hand running through her long blonde hair. "And I think September should go first." September preened and nodded. "Delighted," he said. "Hey," said February. "Hey, hey, 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 hey. I didn't hear the chairman ratify that. Nobody starts till October says who starts, and then nobody else talks. Can we have maybe the tiniest semblance of order here?" He peered at them, small, pale, dressed entirely in blues and grays. "It's fine," said October. His beard was all colors, a grove of trees in autumn, deep browns and fire orange and wine red, an untrimmed tangle across the lower half of his face. His cheeks were apple red. He looked like a friend, like someone you had known all your life. "September can go first. Let's just get it rolling." September placed the end of his sausage in his mouth, chewed daintily, and drained his cider mug. Then he stood up and bowed to the company and began to speak. Laurent Delisle was the finest chief in all of Seattle. At least, Laurent Delisle thought so, and the Michelin stars on his door confirmed him in his opinion. He was a remarkable chef, it is true. His minced lamb brioche had won several awards. His smoked quail and white truffle ravioli had been described in the Gastronome as the 10th wonder of the world. But it was his wine cellar, his wine cellar, that was his source of pride and his passion. "I understand that. The last of the white grapes are harvested in me and the bulk of the reds. I appreciate fine wines, the aroma, the taste, the aftertaste as well." Laurent Delisle bought his wines at auctions from private wine lovers, from reputable dealers. He would also insist on a pedigree for each wine, for wine frauds are, alas, too common. When the bottle is selling for perhaps $5, $10, $100,000 or pounds or euros. The treasure, the jewel, the rarest of the rare, and the ne plus ultra of his temperature-controlled wine cellar was a bottle of 1902 Chateau Lafite. It was on the wine list at $120,000, although it was, in true terms, priceless, for it was the last bottle of its kind. "Excuse me," said August politely. He was the fattest of them all, his thin hair combed in golden wisps across his pink pate. September glared down at his neighbor. "Yes? Is this the one where some rich dude buys the wine to go with the dinner, and the chief decides that the dinner the rich dude ordered isn't good enough for the wine, so he sends out a different dinner? And the guy takes one mouthful, and he's got, like, some rare allergy, and he just dies like that, and the wine never gets drunk after all?" September said nothing. He looked a great deal. Because if it is, you told it before. Years ago. Dumb story then, dumb story now. August smiled. His pink cheeks shone in the firelight. September said, "Obviously, pathos and culture are not to everyone's taste. Some people prefer their barbecues and beer, and some of us like..." February said, "Well, I hate to say this, but he kind of does have a point. It has to be a new story." September raised an eyebrow and pursed his lips. "I'm done," he said abruptly. He sat down on his stump. They looked at each other across the fire, the months of the year. June, hesitant and clean, raised her hand and said, "I have one about a guard on the X-ray machines at LaGuardia Airport who could read all about people from the outlines of their luggage on the screen. And one day she saw a luggage x-ray so beautiful that she fell in love with the person, and she had to figure out which person in the line it was, and she couldn't, and she pined for months and months. And when the person came through again, she knew it this time, and it was the man, and he was a wizened, bless you, old Indian man, and she was pretty and black and like 25, and she knew it would never work out, and she let him go, because she could also see from the shapes of his bags on the screen that he was going to die soon." October said, "Fair enough, young June, tell that one." June stared at him like a spooked animal. "I just did," she said. October nodded. "So you did," he said, before any of the others could say anything. And then he said, "Shall we proceed to my story, then?" February sniffed. "Out of order there, big fella. The man in the chair only tells the story when the rest of us are through. Can't go straight to the main event." May was placing a dozen chestnuts on the grate above the fire, deploying them into patterns with her tongs. "Let him tell his story if he wants to," she said. "God knows it can't be worse than the one about the wine. And I have things to be getting back to. Flowers don't bloom by themselves. All in favor?" "You're taking this to a formal vote," February said. "I cannot believe this. I cannot believe this is happening." He mopped his brow with his handful of tissues, which he pulled from his sleeve. 7 hands were raised. 4 people kept their hands down. February, September, January, and July. "I don't have anything personal on this," said July apologetically. "It's purely procedural. We shouldn't be setting precedents." "It's settled then," said October. "Is there anything anyone would like to say before I begin?" "Yes. Sometimes," said June, "sometimes I think somebody's watching us from the woods, and then I look and there isn't anybody there, but I still think it." April said, "That's because you're crazy." said September to everybody. "That's our April. She's sensitive, but she's still the cruelest." "Enough," said October. He stretched in his chair. He cracked a cob nut with his teeth, pulled out the kernel, and threw the fragments of shell into the fire, where they hissed and spat and popped, and he began his story. And that's where I'll end, because I don't want to go on.
Very nice.
Wow. I'm going to read a little series of poems here. From a couple years ago. What's neat about this series of poems, the problem with this notebook is that the rings don't quite close.
It's because you always try to pull it open, and it doesn't pull open. You have to use the thing.
Yeah.
So you broke it.
Oh.
So now they don't close.
Well, that's what I said. It doesn't work. So.
Ray fills his notebooks.
It's not for me to do a notebook's job for it. It's just for me to use it. If he can't do its job, well, by golly, I've got 100 more over there that'll step on in. Anyway. Okay. When I used to record these meetings in the old days, Melissa had a boombox.
Oh.
And if you can imagine a boombox among pitchers of beer and pizza and stuff, it was...
I can picture it, yeah.
And then I was recording on a cassette, so every 45 minutes I had to remember to flip the cassette.
All of a sudden he'd be playing, or I'd be playing a song.
I'd go, oh!
So we'd hear a click.
Yeah, you'd hear a click. Yeah. A click and a cry of anguish. So, okay, so... this is a series of poems from a couple of years ago when Cass and I were living in Portland. It was before a Portland Jellicle Guild meeting, so I'm kind of like strangely twist-tying things together because this was read to different people. But anyway, I was sitting at this Starbucks near where we lived. The Starbucks I liked because it had this really kind of retro furniture. It had these like oversized chairs that you would imagine finding it in like, you know, Batman in the 60s or something. It really, and I like going there and writing for that reason. It's funny how furniture can draw you to a place you wouldn't think. Anyway, so I went there the afternoon of the meeting, which would have been a Saturday afternoon, and I thought, I want to write a bunch of new poems to read tonight. And so what I did was I wrote a poem, and then I wrote a poem that you'll see is a series of questions, and then I wrote a series of poems to answer the questions. So, ready? I know we haven't done this in 8 years.
I'm trying to pick out a mood here.
It's like Simon and Garfunkel trying to remember the tune, right?
Yes.
Bridge over troubled what?
Yes.
Okay. Tonight's questions.
Tonight's questions.
Why electrify an animal with consciousness? Why point his eyes toward the stars as he shits? Why make fucking the stuff of grunt and prayer? Why the rift from nature, urge to know, consume? Why the dread path to demise with dreams of escape? Okay, first question. Why electrify an animal with consciousness? Electricity. Offered the elixir you drink, and now the stars familiar and the trees shaman. Her body living starlight to the touch, and the farthest dreams close upon this petal. This petal, this moment, this forever moment, and the music consumes you. The water she feeds you crackles with knowing, the grass's friend, the drums, every heart's glad yearning tongue. Come morning, the daylight of get and shove, the hole in hours burned by coins, and explained by some men as penance, as test, as deferred promise for someday's great golden land of light. Come morning and you wonder, what is it for? Should I have drunk? Come morning, something's missing, important. It was there last night in her crystalline smile. In the moment when you forgave all, knew all was well, breathed, relaxed. Missing. Missing? You've drunk the elixir. You're awake now. Walk the earth, sober or laughing, till you find it, or we're wrong, and let go. Why point his eyes toward the stars as he shits? The stars while shitting. In desert, the far-blowing desolation hearts know. Squat in plastic box, thumping sounds of immolation and ecstasies without, I sat with a puzzling book and read its first lines. Suffer, it said. This is why you suffer. This canker of want in you, each of you. Name it a god or devil. This is why you suffer. That you live from first cry, riven and crawl your years to be whole. That you cry up love unto myth, to keep it a step away, that you litigate desire for its blind, brutal wish, build great towers and temples of distraction, cage your every soul in discontent, in bitterest hunger. This is why you suffer. My shit came sudden and raw, and the plastic ceiling above my head exploded. The stars fell in on me. I was a moment so beautiful and dead. Yes, this is why we suffer, for the shattering moment when nothing makes sense, and we finally nod. Why make fucking the stuff of grunt and prayer? Grunt and prayer. I moved inside her a little deeper, a little harder. She grunted, liked it hard, liked it to hurt. Yes, hurt. Oh, make it hurt. Hurt me. Make me forget. Love me. Consume me. Crush my tits. Harder. Deeper. Consume me. I want it. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I withdrew a little. Young. What did I loosed? What demons risen here? This darkened small room. The dinner half eaten on the table. The moonlight radiant and mad through the single window above the brick wall. What demons? I pull back and she breathes hard. Who are you? Just fuck me. Who are you? Just fuck me. 10, 20 years dissolves, 30, 40 one day soon, and I still wonder, who was she that night? Which she do I mean? Which night? Breathe heavy remembering, breathe sad. I want it too. Why let him speak in knowing in lies and truths? Lies and truths. The last time on phone, my father was lost to space and time, raving in hospital bed, waving his legless stumps around while nurses murmured and checked numbers. We'd fight them together, the bastards, the enemies, the ones keeping us far, the ones who had not told him this is how it would end, this drowning, this ravaging despair, this freak tempest of professional eyes, this humiliation, this taking and taking and taking. I think of him now, bones in the earth, free of time and pain and all he loved. Were his life's truths any softness beneath those last hours? The truths, the loves, the promises vowed to someday. I wonder and I wish I could have given him a warm hand on his cheek, a word of comfort, everything is all right, and this is a lie, and this is truth. Why the rift from nature, urge to know, consume. Rift from nature. There were moments, maybe three, maybe fewer, when I uncoiled back to root, into soil, into sunshine, exhaled, and again, the world we are drinking each other, the world we lay in wordless song, dreaming at night, the world, the wings inside my ribs, the web between my toes, uncoiled through clouds when I rained, fruit when I was eaten, and shit seed back to earth. Moments when the stars too were like fruit, hanging impossibly from endless skies. And what was left of me danced and died. And what I was, and what I possessed, and what made the world, and no reason why. And finally, why the dread path to demise with dreams of escape? Dread path. Tonight's hungers are new and old. Every face wears them and looks to another to explain. Cities crackle by the sparkling crowds pushing, shouting into taverns, and those awaiting a last hour, and those fearing a familiar voice and its knowing hand. Tonight's hungers range canyon and jungle, green sea and white woods, and some fill bellies, and some fuck whatever sweet they may. Tonight's hungers left us by a combustible god, or molecule, or alien star parent. Tonight the tavern's even more crowded, the rhythms beastier, the clothes tighter, the words exchanged more plain. Tonight's hungers draw us nearer the end, by weapon, by evolution, by the return of whoever led us down here, seeming bid to wonder and wait, or by obscure thought, hurling heart shadows, that's nothing's to wait for, everything's to be done. We are the tinder that needs gathering, and the ignition.
So this story is called Hook, Line, and Sinker. It was written about 60 years ago, which is why the prices mentioned in it will seem a bit low.
Ah, good point.
It was a slow day, even for January. 20 past noon and not one sale. John was alone in the store. Bill, the other salesman, was out to lunch. The two of them had been marking jewelry all morning. John walked to the front of the store and looked out the front door window. The rain was just letting up. Across the street, he saw a cop ticketing an out-of-state car. Well, somebody's got to suffer, he thought to himself. The cop appeared to be the only sign of life on Union Street. John walked back to the desk, picked up an invoice, and started back to work. He saw that a man and a woman had stopped outside and were looking over the window displays. He could see the man pointing to something and the woman shaking her head. The man started to open the door, but the woman pulled at his sleeve and was still shaking her head. They were talking loud, but John couldn't make out what they were saying. He thought, "You coming in or ain't you?" The door opened and the two came in. They had stopped talking and paused just inside the door. John dropped the invoice he was working on and walked toward them. "Looks like it clearing up, don't it?" The two didn't answer. "Something I can show you, folks?" "We'd like some luggage," the man said. Hardly had he spoken when the woman said, "We're only looking." John figured it out fast. He knew he could sell the man easy. It was that damn woman he'd have to work on. He smiled and addressed the woman. "Was it something you wanted to match up, or are you making up a new set?" "No, we just want to see a bag," she said. John thought to himself, "In that case, lady, just step over here to the mirror." He started to walk to the back of the store. They followed. That was a good sign. "Have you any particular color or leather in mind?" "No, a man's bag and something cheap," the woman answered. John looked quickly over the stock. There was a 2-bit commission, that's a quarter, on any piece of luggage he sold, and another 2 bits on anything over a year old. Still eyeing the stock, John asked, "What size did you have to have? Something in a 2-suiter, perhaps?" The man turned to the woman. "Is that what we want?" "Yes," the woman said. "Let me see that one up there." She was pointing to one of the high-priced bags, but John took it down anyway. "How much is that?" "I'll check on that. Let me open it up and look at the price tag." John knew what the price was, but figured the longer he could hold them, the better he could work on them. "That's $65 plus the tax, ma'am." "Put it back," the woman said. John spotted an old blue plastic case edged with leather. It had been in the store since the war. "Here's one that's been very popular," he said. "All the edges are real leather, and it's got real brass hardware. Look at the name stamped on the lock," he said, handing the bag to the man. "See, it's stamped Empire. You know that name, of course. If you do, I'll eat the goddamn thing," he thought to himself. The man just nodded his head. "Is that a man's suitcase?" the woman asked. "Oh, yes, ma'am." That was a lie, but he felt sure he could handle it. "The manufacturers are making men's and ladies' stuff a lot alike these days. It's the style." The woman looked at him a little suspiciously, John thought. "Maybe I better watch my step with this old gal." "How much is it?" she said. "That's $17.95, ma'am. Haven't you anything cheaper?" "Not in a man's 2-suiter. Perhaps I could show you something slightly smaller." The original title of this story was The 2-suiter. It was changed, and the change was the author's, not ours. John reached for another bag, plastic and slightly smaller, but pretty near as old as the one he was showing them. He knew the price tag was missing, and he knew the price, $12, but he took another chance, thinking if he upped the price on this suitcase, they'd be more likely to take the blue one. "That's $16, ma'am. It's not the size you want, but it's cheaper." He placed the 2 suitcases side by side, opened, on the counter. The woman shut and opened both bags a couple of times. John picked up the blue one and said, "You know, there isn't too much difference in the price. If I were you folks, I'd take this one, because it's the size you want, and in the long run, that's what counts. However, this other one is still a good buy at the price." He wished he hadn't upped the price, fearing that if they took it because they couldn't swing the blue one, he'd be in it for overcharging. The woman pointed to the smaller bag. "How much would this one be with tax?" Now he was damn sorry he'd lied. "Just a minute, I'll figure it out for you." He calculated the price on the inside flap of his sales book. $19.52 with all the taxes, ma'am." Then he thought of a way out. "Are you folks from town here?" he asked the man. "No, we come down from Springfield." "Well, say, if you folks really like the blue bag, I can fix it up so you won't have to pay any taxes, you being out of state and all." At this, the woman took a real interest. Then what would be the full price on it? John felt he had them now. $17.95, ma'am, and I can put your initials on it for you. Won't cost you anything either, ma'am." The woman opened it and shut the bag again, turned to the man and asked him how he liked it. He just shook his head yes. "You say these edges are real leather?" the woman asked. John assured her that they were, and even though the bag was plastic, it would outwear some leathers, and besides, one had to look close to tell it wasn't all leather. "Well, we'll take it," the woman said. "Can you put the initials on it now?" "Surely. Take about 5 minutes, ma'am." "That'll be fine." The woman opened her pocketbook, took out the change purse, and handed him 2 tens. You said 1795? That's right, ma'am, said John, taking the money. Getting so these $10 bills aren't going to buy anything, the way prices keep going up. The pair nodded in agreement. John wrote out the sales slip, marked it with a Z, the store code for year-old merchandise, and rung it up. He initialed the bag and asked if he could show them anything else, to which they said no. John handed the bag to the man and gave the woman the change. As they were going out, he said, Now, any time you folks want to match up that bag, you just drop in and we'll fix you up. Fix you up good, he thought to himself. After they left, John lit up a cigarette, went back to the desk, and began putting price tickets on some silver pins. About that time, Bill, the other salesman, came in. Sell anything while I was gone, John? Yeah, said John, without looking up from his work, that old blue plastic bag that's been hanging around here since the year one. What'd you do, use a gun? Nah, I just gave them the old line, and they fell for it hook, line, and sinker. Bill took off his coat and hung it up on a nail driven into the edge of one of the shelves. Talking about lines, I heard a good one at lunch. For making women or money? Money. Ed Parker, the hat salesman from Springfield, was telling about a man and a woman acting like they didn't know from nothing, loading that town with phony tens, and... Bill? No. Yes.
As somebody said to Neil Young, said one time, the songs are all the same. And he looks back from his microphone and goes, there's only one song. Once I thought I saw you in a cloudy, hazy night, dancing on the lights from star to star. All across the moon, I know that's who you are. I saw your brown eyes turning once to fire, fire, somewhere safer where the feelings stay. I want to love you, but I can't so long away. Ooh, I'm going away, all the way across the universe and find my soul. I am just a dreamer, and you are just a dreamer. That word you feel when time just slips away between us and a foggy dreamin'. You are like a hurricane, it's not your life, and I'm getting away. It's okay, shake me with a we I'm back. I kind of lose myself. I'm not really here, but that just happens sometimes. Yeah. So anyway. Oh man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you. Old man, look at my life. I'm a lot like you. Old man, take a look at my life. 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of you. Love lost at such a cost. Give me things that won't get lost. Like a coin that won't get tossed. I'm rolling home to you. I'm a lot like you. I need someone to love me, to hold me through. Oh, I want to look in my eyes and you can tell that's lullabies looking fine. Run around the same old town. Doesn't mean that much to me. Doesn't mean that much to you. I've been first and last. Look at how the time has passed. But I'm now alone at last. And I'm rolling home. Thing sometimes, not have it all sound the same. So. And that's the cover section until the next one comes on. Oh, that was the thing. Oh, damn it. Shit.
What?
Sorry.
Your song?
Kind of a cover. Anything you want at Ray and Cassie's restaurant. You can get anything you want at Ray and Cassie's restaurant. Walk right in to some Anatomy Street. Get you a meal that you just can't beat. You can get anything you want at Ray and Cassie's restaurant. Sorry, I meant to do it earlier.
One prayer. In a dream of aunts and uncles, the arrangements were made. First they took one, and then another. Cigar smoke mushroomed from the stack of a toy train, while I sat among stacks of carpets trying to say something intelligent about a song. In the basement hung a gas mask, dangling for years from a warped pool cue, and stuffed into a pair of my father's old metal cleats was the same bag of hairpins, exactly the way they were left. In a room of blankets, their beds fell away. Through the curtainless window, they moved Godward like a slash mark carving up a painting. I set my life alongside the others, like chattering teeth in a joke shop window, a row of heads nodding along a wooden booth. They lived in days when people wore gold and smoked indoors, boiled radiators for gas money, and shot through the pine barrens with flames bursting from their lake pipes. Tonight, my child tosses handfuls of chive into the fire. To her, being an artist is an excuse for everything. All hearts and thumbs rooted deeply in something. All prayers start with one great last line, but end up as apologies to the dead who have their own problems. Mm-hmm. Wow. Holy shit.
Very nice.
Wow. Joe!
Yeah.
We love you, man.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Get your ass here.
Yeah.
Pronto.
I don't know, huh?
Yeah.
Anything that is going to be read out loud about marijuana deserves a prelude.
A prelude.
Okay, thanks, yeah.
Let's see.
Ancient and modern healer. A recent article at Slate.com discusses what I have long suspected regarding the antibacterial property of cannabis. My own theory is sourced in the Bible, of all places. Linguists have shown the word cannabis is of Semitic origin and was unknown in Greek language. So in the translation for Aramaic, Hebrew, to Greek, scribes incorrectly chose the word calamus instead of cannabis. In the Old Testament, God gave the command to manufacture the holy anointing oil. God was very specific in those days. He said that myrrh, cinnamon, cassia, and the sweet, fragrant flowers of calamus were to be distilled, as a perfumer would do, into olive oil. The formula is specific, and it's about 4 pounds of calamus flowers, distilled with cinnamon and myrrh. Many species of this now extinct tree contain high levels of alkaloids, some of which are psychedelic, like DMT, into 2 quarts of oil, an extremely potent concoction. God also imposed rules and regulations regarding the use and limits of this oil, as one would use a powerful drug. One such rule is that it must be controlled by the priests, and cannot be used outside temple or given to just anyone. The oil is used to anoint Christian priests and heal the sick of the Jewish elite. Jesus Christ means the anointed one. One of his breaks with Jewish law or crew want to use the oil to heal the impoverished, sick of leprosy and blindness and skin infections by pouring large amounts of this oil over them, and then after a while plunging them into the river to wash off the remaining oil in a baptism. This must have been a very intense experience, not only for the patient, but for anyone witnessing this event. Seeing God and having your disease cured in a single act of one man with a bottle of oil would be seen as a miracle even today. I think that the holy anointing oil is a powerful drug of antibacterial, antiviral, and psych-altering properties. In this light, the Jesus story makes much more sense. Who could doubt he was the Son of God? Who would not follow him after witnessing these healing miracles and hearing about the cosmic consciousness attained by those so healed? It is overwhelming to contemplate what the world would be like had these early Greek scribes used the correct word. How one little mistake in translation can totally alter the course of the world forever. Cannabis was often used by most ancient Semitic tribes. These are large stone pots that are coated with burned cannabis resin and seeds. Archaeological finds indicate that piles of cannabis flowers were burned in a tent or hut, like a smoke lodge. Cannabis flowers are still offered as a sacrament in this way by Ethiopian Coptic Christians, the earliest Christian sect, I believe, as well as possibly being descendants of one of the lost tribes of Israel.
To David Hartley.
Mr. Hartley.
This is a poem called The Writer. It's a poem I like. Richard Wilbur's one of my favorite writers. The Writer. In her room at the prow of the house, where the light breaks and the windows are tossed with linden, my daughter is writing a story. I pause in the stairwell, hearing from her shut door a commotion of typewriter keys like a chain hauled over a gunwale. Young as she is, the stuff of her life is a great cargo, and some of it heavy. I wish her a lucky passage. But now it is she who pauses, as if to reject my thought and its easy figure. A stillness greatens in which the whole house seems to be thinking. And then she is at it again with a bunched clamor of strokes and again is silent. I remember the dazed starling which was trapped in that very room 2 years ago, how we stole in, lifted a sash, and retreated not to affright it. And how, for a helpless hour, through the crack of the door, we watched the sleek, wild, dark, and iridescent creature batter against the brilliance, drop like a glove to the hard floor or the desktop, and wait then, humped and bloody, for the wits to try it again. And how our spirits rose when, suddenly sure, it lifted off from a chair back, beating a smooth course for the right window and clearing the sill of the world. It is always a matter, my darling, of life or death, as I had forgotten. I wish what I wished you before, but harder.
Nice.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
That was good.
This could be a friend that Melissa hasn't met. Jerry Dillon, who lives down in Connecticut. This guy went to college with originally. He's a fiction writer, and his stories have shown up in the Cynical recently, so he's around. Anyway, he had to work tonight, but he sent along the story, and he said, "Would you please read this at the Jellicle Guild? It is an important story to me personally." So anyway, the story is called All Good Things, I believe.
Oh.
I came in at dusk for the night crew at the Burger Angel Register Trademark fast food restaurant. Brittany was the shift supervisor in charge. I was the Will Riker to her Jean-Luc Picard. I slipped off my jacket to reveal a minor management button-down shirt, not the snazzier crew jersey, and picked up my register keys. Your ex-girlfriend was here again, Brittany said. Maybe I should send her a copy of your schedule. She's not coming to see me, I replied. It's not the food, I'm sure. You said you wanted to still be friends. Just friends, right? That's true. I tried to be her friend even if dating was out of the question. At one time, I said, didn't work out. Mea culpa. Was my fault. My repentant angel, Brittany cooed. Sarcastically, I should guess. It sounded pretty important for you to try last time you talked about it. Why? I failed to do it the time before. I couldn't even try after we broke up. Couldn't even see my old girlfriend. She married that guy, even had a kid. It was years before I realized she didn't dump me for him, but I was the one who almost stole her from her future husband. It was a whole paradigm twist. I realized how great an opportunity I had lost, had denied myself by not being her friend, by not keeping in touch. Hopefully denied her, too. Didn't want it to happen again, twice. Not if I could do better this time, but I guess I failed again, only in a different way. I even deleted all my pictures of her. I twisted my arms like Ray Bolger in The Wizard of Oz. The first woman I mean, not the one whom you saw tonight, or today. I had confused even myself by keeping names anonymous, especially speaking with the third her. Was it cathartic, she asked. No, I only wished I still had him later. Don't share that on your next date, buddy, Brittany quietly whispered. Are you sure it was her, I questioned. Which her, she smiled widely. I'm sure, Billy Piper clone. Billy Piper Doctor Who, or Billy Piper's secret diary of a call girl? I know which gutter your mind is at, Brittany smiled wickedly, then she fell back into her chair. Oh, I had so much beer last night. Amateur, I thought with a small smile within my frontal lobe solely. Can't take a hangover. Was it her favorite clubs, a.k.a. the lesbian clubs, as she liked to call them? I've got cramps right down to my uterus. She smothered her forehead into both her hands. Her fingers spread about her face and into her red hair. I think I need some medication, or maybe I need to go to the hospital for an x-ray. Now I felt bad about my jocular thoughts. Are you sure it's not, you know... Don't even go there, Buckaroo, Brittany pointed out. Pointed not only her index finger at me, but her entire right arm. She held the pose like a Greek statue until a silly smile formed upon her lips and she dropped her arm. I hope it was at least good beer. Brittany shook her head at me. Ooh, don't do that, I said as I came around the corner. Brittany had let her hair down from the bun on top of her head. Her scarlet curls swam about her face. What? Brittany said. I don't know, I lied. Not telling her how good she looked. Are you feeling better? Yeah, but I just put Pepto-Bismol's balance sheet into the black. I'm trying to put some food in my stomach right now. Want some yogurt and fruit? I thought you were lactose intolerant. Brittany shrugged, then she looked up and depressed the intercom button in her headset. Lorenzo, stay in position. I look up and you're on grill and then you're on sandwiches and you're bagging. Brittany scolded over our headsets. Then more quietly, she added to me, we need better drugs for AADD. I'll get right on that, I said. You do that, she replied. Lorenzo came into the office. I was just trying to help. Heartless, Brittany. I have a heart. A big heart, she looked up to me. Don't I have a heart? Just like 10 woodsmen, I said. Hey, Jared, what time do you leave? Lorenzo asked me. He's staying till I leave, Brittany replied before I could answer. Are we getting outside food or eating our stuff, he asked. Ordering out, I guess. It helps keep my food costs lower when you guys don't get the employee discount or the five-fingered one. She stared at Lorenzo steadily. I can get you a big, juicy hot dog. You want the foot-long? Lorenzo asked slightly salaciously. I don't understand, Brittany said. I don't want a hot dog. Did she really not catch the double entendre, or was she playing along, playing dumb? No, she'd prefer the bun. She frowned. Okay, I get it now. Funny. Lorenzo returned to the service line and Brittany picked up the schedule she was working on. I picked up the food safety log and started to fill it out. I grabbed the electronic thermometer. It was still set for Celsius, so I was the last to use it. We record temperatures in Fahrenheit, but I always leave it Celsius just to give the next person a hard time. I know, sometimes I just amuse myself a bit too much. Okay, I'll give anyone $5 to beat up Lorenzo. I know a bunch will do it for free, just stay off the cameras, I said. And no one sees anything. He trips, or so my accident report will say. Brittany smiled guilely, her eyes sparkling spritefully. I wondered for a moment if she was serious, or exactly how serious she was. I'm being paid to sit here, Brittany stated. We all were. Our supplies driver had finished his delivery, and we all joined him for an unscheduled break in the dining room. He scanned the room, checking for any security camera that would relay everyone's goofing off. I knew we were safe. My wife's Netflix list came around to Juno before I left on this run, Frank said. He was our truck driver. A company baseball cap rested on the table, and his now bald head was prominently revealed. Only hope she sent it back by now so I can get something good for my day off. Oh, that's a great movie, Brittany said. It is, I agreed. However, not this again. Brittany rolled her eyes. Go ahead, show everyone how wrong you are. The film was anti-male. Juno's father loved her, but had no clue as to what was going on in his daughter's life, even when he gave her the seminal advice in the film. Her baby's adoptive father had to change, but couldn't. Grow up, you mean? Brittany interjected. Okay, he wanted to make music and read Japanese manga. And inappropriately became involved with his child's birth mother, she added. Worst of all, I continued, her boyfriend gave up the track team for her. He was too removed from her at the start of the movie, and I know they did that for dramatic effect and make the viewer think she may be going for the older guy, but he can't be on the team and be with her. It's saying men have to change to the way their women want them. Well, isn't that right? She smiled. I shook my head slightly before starting to return to work and to check on our firelighter's timers. Brittany swiveled herself about in the booth seat and put her feet up on the plastic cushion. So my shipper friend came over this weekend. I stopped what I was doing. Any tale that began "my shipper friend came over" is one worth hearing. She had me try on her push-up bra. Honestly, my boobs were up to here. I felt like I was wearing a Sealy mattress. She's having issues with her boyfriend. They've just been together too long, grown apart, but aren't willing to admit it. So they fight and fight. I think I could be in a relationship with a guy as long as I didn't have to be in love. Ooh, sweetie, honey, my baby. Poor guy, I thought. Or is that lucky? Our timer buzzer finally sounded, and I went to see to the alarm. I came back to the dining area with the driver's chicken nuggets. The conversation had quickly turned pretty blue, pretty crude. It was funny, but my mother taught me better. They were joking about prison, jailhouse bitches, and fudge packing. I'll spare you most of the graphic details. My mother did teach me better, though not all the details. Maybe I didn't learn all that well. I feel okay now, except I have diarrhea, Brittany said. Talk about muddy waters. That's because you're not getting packed enough, the truck driver said. You heard the manager of the new Cambridge store got 9 months, 2 years probation, and has to register as a sex offender. I think he got off easy. He had alcohol and Viagra for the burly police sergeant he thought was a 14-year-old girl. He had everything but the Betty and Veronica comic books. Frank continued his thoughts about the first meeting with his cellmate. In his store, the loop for the milkshake machine kept disappearing, and they were blaming the drivers. How can you deliver half a case? That's not for, Brittany started, that's not for internal use. A lot of things aren't for internal use, but get used. I stood up from my wooden chair. I had to see what warnings were on the tube. He went to check? Oh, he always thought it was safe. Frank laughed. No, not that one, Brittany said coldly. What? Why? I just don't like it. I looked to her face. Her jaw was not set in any smile, not a frown either. Not even the look she always had after a staff meeting, like she'd been ridden hard like a charger and put down whip by a negligent groom. It was new to me. She looked serious and determined. It was not a view of her face to which I was accustomed. And so, dear reader, yes, I am breaking the fourth wall, looking up from the paper page or computer screen on which you are reading, speaking directly to you like I'm Thomas Hardy or Charles Dickens. In writing, an author is supposed to show, not tell. Well, Brittany just showed me, and I just gotta tell. Maybe my ears are lying to me, but that one is not the joke, but the butt, no pun intended, of the joke. Yep, me. Brittany just defends me, seizing any attempt to make me target A for any insulting references. Even good-natured ribbing amongst coworkers, or less than good nature, she may think. And I realize something. Realize I am doing with her what I always failed to do with other women. Like the woman Brittany accused of looking for me. She and I can be just friends, friends so close she did what she did, defending me when even I felt no need to. If I am still suffering from a long-gone broken heart, she finally mends it tonight with words for sutures. She treats me better than any girlfriend has, would, or could just now. I feel like somebody loves me again, but the real word needs to be trust, not love. Not Valentine hearts, not saccharine sentiments. Trust, and friendship. It is a good thing. It is all good things. The end.
Ooh. Yeah. I'm very pleased to be here reading for tonight. I'm going to read six poems. The first is What Madness Is. what madness is. Madness is anger's placenta, a thorny cord that strangles, a finger that writes no more on death's fluids. Madness is this confession. I have encountered my enemy. I wanted to set fire to my enemy. I wanted to perform unnatural acts on my enemy. Madness is a dream in the morning of transitory waters, and the ruby blood of I love you moving between the tired legs of a tired woman. Madness is that white mania that leaps from stony heart to stony heart, turns the universal mysteries into fishhooks and phantasms. Straight out of the Black Sea comes the madness of Amen, the madness of allure, of sex that cripples your senses. It is that vigorous. Madness is the tight knot of wisdom and hatred, and later ecstasy of a kind known only to the saints. Anarchic and unassuming, madness brings a coward's blades to the throats of the world's inquisitors. Madness is no vindication, no escape plan. Only these words, clenching inside you like fists, like teeth, like closed eyes.
Wow.
Interesting camera work.
Yeah.
This is called Callot. The silences of moments don't support me like they used to. Heartbeats, like the ding-dong of bells, pass through me and don't stay. It's embarrassing, the way living in a near-deserted town embarrasses the few who stay on. Love threatens me. Faith comes at me like a grimy rag, wants to scour my face. My clasped hands render clear blood, but not a clear mind. And the surrounding desert song is monotonous, even when the coyotes kick in. Desert sand keeps nothing out, holds nothing in. My gestures look tranquil, feel frantic. I've tossed my reflection into noon's white heat, which clings like silica spider webs, adjusts hue without color. At night, I lay awake, my body dirtied by unrecountable dreams. When it's dawn, something reclaims me, and I move toward the excesses of light. This is called A Thousand Signs. I have been naked in soul and body with women whose names escape me. I have shared my body's portfolio with men whose hearts were too heated to resonate anything but divine urgency. It makes me wonder, is love a sickbed? Can we love ourselves only if we see our lust for others as disease? I am drawn to an impossible point of light, a sign outside my national language. I am free to read it. I am free to view the wreckage of a thousand signs in a thousand places. I have seen light. Men who love men are splotches of sunlight in the shadows that cross the deck. Women who love women are rivers of questions on a desert planet. The rest of us tremble. Intend to be happy. Take love back from the bold ones who have sheltered it. In the end, we are all caught, made to walk the game plank. In the end, every night is All Hallows' Eve. The gilded sky covers all of us, and, regardless of choices, we all take it hard when we die. This poem is called Your Poems on My Patio, and the poem is dedicated to one of my favorite poets, Jalua Marbrook. Your Poems on My Patio, for Jalua. The mountains are perfect this morning, so I reread your perfect poems. Knit 2, purl 3, knit 2, purl 2. And there on the page is a scarf in hearty woolen adverbs and adjectives. I would do nearly anything to know that someone lingered over my images as I do yours, and I would do it twice to find you borrowed one of my phrases. I must know that your poems, so beautiful they are treacherous, paralyze my pen. Oh, I realize this isn't an appropriate way to show gratitude, nor is it an answer to my reflection in the cracked mirror of my own regrets. This morning, my friend, I found autumn and the sea and terror and love and wonder and pain and such enviable nourishment that I can never forgive you. Yes, I am tired, and even the surreal sky, even the spirit-filled mountains don't rouse me to action. I read instead. Read your poems and sip at a mimosa, because it's never too early for champagne. This is called Stone Steps. I don't want to go to people's parties anymore. We have rented a second floor apartment with stone steps and a stone balcony looking over the courtyard. I don't want to disturb the hummingbirds at our feeder by opening the door to go out for how do you do's and I'd love another drink. We have rented this apartment, you see, and I want to wander around it silently, thinking of poems, finding misplaced items. 2 weeks ago, the blind man on the first floor died. His name was Albert. He went out every day for a walk around the swimming pool, and look what it got him. He's dead. I don't think I like people's parties anymore. They make me feel like a too large child, pretending to know the right things to say or do. I want to wander the catacombs of my head, learn calligraphy, French, history of the paintings of the Dutch masters. I don't want to remember how it was. I want only to see what might be. My heart is breaking at people's parties. Sexual desire whistles the same tunes as sexual decay when the conversations turn to love. And after all, what is there left to talk about after the politics of war, the ethical poses of religions, the egregiously bad behavior of the new movie legends? I'm quite satisfied thinking of your ankles touching mine beneath our sheets. I'm happy seeing the wind harass the palm trees. I like the taste of chocolates, potato chips, and ice cream more than the taste of wine or gin. The days are becoming thick with indifference. How can I live like this? The other side of panic. It begins with the desert's hot sky, mendacious as always, alchemizing grief and loathing into love stories. Where is the other side of panic? A dug-in deep lethargy that makes your marrow itch. Anyway, the desert underwrites your soul's story. You become untethered from yourself, which may or may not be a good thing. Such intricacy. People in the sand looking for closure as if there was such an animal. We'll do this so we can have closure, they say, when what they mean is they want every gory detail. They want to smell and taste the who, what, where, when, why, in each sanctification of violence. I dream a lot in this desert. My dreams turn to fish line, which I use to sew what is real to what is not.
Oh my God.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Martina.
Man.
Ray, Katie, you see me? Anybody else there?
Hello.
This is Judy from Kibbutz Near Oz. I'm happy to join you at your Jellicoe meeting. I'm going to be reading this haiku that Ray put in the October Seneca. Okay, so here we go. And if I'm reading too slow or too fast, there's not anything anyone can do about it. But one day we'll be able to do this live. We'll see. Okay, here I go. Hints of gray. Birds play afternoon jazz. Rice on the stove. Upon arising, a cool glass of water and a dose of poems. Talk about evolution. It's now and it's always. Only language changes. June birds. Each takes a solo before the heat of day. The call of the crow. I peel away my dreams, and here I am. Mouse tail wags on blinds. Daughter calls 911. Snake at window. Cool glass oasis. Daughter is tempted. Rollicking wild birds. Ecstatic morning. Weary, I rise. Fall onto the bed. Bounce into morning. Check for missing parts. Oh, mosquito. My ankle regrets evening acquaintance. Sell your soul. Trade or mind. Borrow emptiness. Such small amounts. Mercy in teaspoons. Then an empty bowl. Morning glory. Hummingbird dances breakfast. Every leaf alive. Empty coffee cup. So soon it's over. Nostalgia. Small body uncurls into morning, a pearl in the sun. Ceiling fan dances each moment, a true optimist. Tower climbs up stalk. Fall gift, kibbutz contentment. Even miracles tip hat to sunset.
There she is.
Wow. That's great. Yay, Judith.
That was really good.
Yeah.
Stone steps. I don't want to go to people's parties anymore. We have rented a second floor apartment with stone steps and a stone balcony looking over the courtyard. I don't want to disturb the hummingbirds at our feeder by opening the door to go out for how do you do's, and I'd love another drink. We have rented this apartment, you see, and I want to wander around it silently, thinking of poems, finding misplaced items. 2 weeks ago, the blind man on the first floor died. His name was Albert. He went out every day for a walk, around the swimming pool, and look what it got him. He's dead. I don't think I like people's parties anymore. They make me feel like a too large child, pretending to know the right thing to say or do. I want to wander the catacombs of my head, learn calligraphy, French, history of the paintings of the Dutch masters. I don't want to remember how it was. I want only to see what might be. My heart is breaking at people's parties. Sexual desire whistles the same tunes as sexual decay when the conversations turn to love. And after all, what is there left to talk about after the politics of war, the ethical poses of religions, the egregiously bad behavior of the new movie legends? I'm quite satisfied thinking of your ankles touching mine beneath our sheets. I'm happy seeing the wind harass the palm trees. I like the taste of chocolates, potato chips, and ice cream more than the taste of wine or gin. The days are becoming thick with indifference. How can I live like this?
You know when I learned to write poetry? I learned it when I understood what the word metaphor meant.
Oh, okay.
That was how I, when I understood that you can make one thing stand for another.
How old were you?
I think in my 20s. Bad poetry. Yeah.
Did you start writing in your 20s?
No, I started writing when I was 17. Mm-hmm. I had a crush on a girl who wrote poetry.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's what got you to write poetry, Bill?
It was. It was, and it was really awful poetry. I was reading it recently. And it was just really bad. And it was bad for years and years.
Yeah. But then you sort of got... You developed... We all wrote bad poetry at one time, I suppose.
Well,
I don't know about Rick, but I feel that.
What? Are you kidding me?
Really?
I wrote lots of more shit.
Did you really?
Of course. Everybody does.
Okay.
But what I was... But the thing that bugged me about it was not that someone looking at it would say, oh, this isn't very good. It's not very well written. It's not very imaginative.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't honest.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hardest thing to do in art, is to be honest.
Yeah.
Because being honest doesn't mean simply uttering your sensations of a given moment or the given thought in your head. It's like a verb. It's not a noun. It's a ongoing state that you struggle with greater and lesser levels of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at a bunch of poems I wrote for this girl I dated for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And the first poem I wrote for her, it's not a great poem, but it's honest. It's not even much of a love poem per se. It's a sweet poem, and it's not very romantic, but it's sweet and it's simple. And a few poems later, because I just decided to keep doing it, they got more and more dishonest. I was trying to write poems that were to a relationship I wanted to be in and wasn't in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so more and more they developed a snarky tone. They just did things that I could see to myself. This is learning about writing poetry, but it's kind of like learning about driving by like repeatedly driving into a wall. Like, how many times do you need to drive into the wall to realize that driving into the wall is not a good thing? Mm-hmm. Not good for you, not good for the car.
Yeah.
And so I was looking at this poetry, and it would. So, how do you write honest? I don't know how you write honest. I mean, I know it's a hard thing to do, and it doesn't necessarily produce art. But what I would say to anybody making any kind of art is that the core thing you can do is be honest. And that's the hardest thing to do because there's no instruction book for how to do it.
Right.
Because no one knows what that means to you in a given moment in your life. Or whether that honesty can be embodied in a piece of art.
Richard Wilbur, The Undead, 1961. Even as children, they were late sleepers, preferring their dreams, even when quick with monsters, to the world with all its breakable toys, its compacts with the dying. From the stretched arms of withered trees, they turned, fearing contagion of the mortal, and even under the plums of summer, drifted like winter. Secret, unfriendly, pale, possessed of one wish, a thirst for mere survival, they came, as all extremists do, in time to a sort of grandeur. Now to their Balkan battlements above the vulgar town of their first lives, they rise at the moon's rising, strange at their utter self-concern, should in the end have left them selfless. Mirrors fail to perceive them as they float through the great hall and up the staircase, nor are the cobwebs broken. Into the pallid night emerging, wrapped in their flapping capes, routinely maddened by a wolf's cry, they stand for a moment, stoking the mind's eye. With lewd thoughts of the pressed flowers and bric-a-brac of rooms with something to lose, of love dismembered dolls and children buried in quilted sleep. They're so lovable. And then they are off in a negative frenzy, their black shapes cropped into sudden bats that swarm, burst, and are gone, thinking of a thrush cold in the leaves who has sung his few summers truly, or an old scholar resting his eyes at last. We cannot be much impressed with vampires, colorful though they are. Nevertheless, their pain is real and requires our pity. Think how sad it must be to thirst always for a scorned elixir, the salt quotidian blood which, if mistrusted, has no savor, to prey on life forever and not possess it, as rock hollows, tide after tide, glassily strand the sea.
This is my vampire poem, which you already have seen published. I read it recently, but I'm going to read it now because it is Halloween.
It's now officially Halloween.
And also, I don't know how much I was inspired by Richard Wilbur, whose poem, of course, I read many years ago. But this is when it's also wake up in the morning, write a poem sort of thing. What she doesn't like about vampires, she doesn't like the absence of color in their skin and the way the skin lies deep, rich, and slack, like the cover of an old couch. And she doesn't like the empty hurt in their eyes. It's like an endless corridor of unfurnished rooms. That they make a dungeon of immortality is another thing. They talk of marvelous freedoms, but haunt their own nights and bunker their days in dead sleep. Their bland castles are interchangeable. They travel blind, and they talk of blood and wine as though they are connoisseurs instead of junkies. Never mind that in place of mirrors, they use feasts of lovers to feed their cravings for reflection, or that when they bite, they leave a mark. Mostly, she doesn't like the way their exquisite sensibilities are blunted by a dull surge that trickles thickly through their waxy veins, and she doesn't like the way their aimlessness shoots fear into her, and the way her fear eats her words. She doesn't like the frozen quality of her own thoughts when she is with them that will finally thaw later when they are gone. She composes all she wants to say ahead of time and writes poems by day that somehow can never be read aloud after sunset. She doesn't like that after being with them, she can only see clearly at night, or that she sees things that aren't there, like visions of them as happy, playing children, or the illusion of a light burning inside them that calls her to visit them. And she doesn't like that she sleeps more soundly when they go away, yet she misses their hurting eyes and their aimless, toothy smiles.
This isn't about vampires at all, is it?
No.
Finally! I've heard it four times and I finally got that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll read this one. Entitled The People Versus Buddha. Drunk on the wine, the emptiness, the caring, our ship of blood embarks its battered port, coursing arteries north, veins south, to the silent canals of the fingers, where a bright red drop wells up on one tip, pricked by the sadness of time. In still and cool museum halls sits the Buddha, magnificent, sturdy, calm, emanating eternity. His upturned bronze palms lie bloodless under harsh halogen glare, carry the shadows of wrongs, fashion the hands to forgiveness. Beneath his full gaze we crumble, or sputter, drift, reform, ride the crests, weather the troughs, chase the moonlight, forever stuck at the wheel. For you, one evening, it all fell away. Under your tree, you stopped pursuing, even as you ran down the hillside. And we, too, seldom and brief, watch it all without clamor or cold. Sail out, free and open, leaving our name at the shoreline. Yet our ship of blood will snag again on tides of memory and desire. And not today, not yet, not until we choose to ditch this mortal craft, will we join you in your voyage.
Tom Robbins is pretty good.
He's very good.
He's kind of a shambling hippie philosopher.
Which is
he's completely up your alley.
So, if you haven't read it, I don't even really need to fill you in, because the reason why I'm picking this passage is just the way he talks. I was reading this and I was just like, I have to read this out loud to somebody because it's just an amazing little page and a half. So, but in brief, the main character, Sissy, was born with very big thumbs.
Yeah.
And she is, at this point, hitchhiking a lot because that is what the thumbs are leading her to do. That's her calling. So, one June, Richmond, Virginia woke up with its brakes on and kept them on all summer. That was okay. It was the Eisenhower years and nobody was going anywhere. Not even Sissy. That is to say, she wasn't going far. Up and down Monument Avenue, perhaps, hitchhiking up and down that broad boulevard so dotted with enshrined cannons and heroic statuary that it is known throughout the geography of the dead as a banana belt for snuff generals. The old capital of the Confederacy marked time in the heat. Its boots kicked up a little tobacco dust, a little wisteria pollen, and that was it. Each morning, including Sundays, the sun rose with a golf tee in its mouth. Its rays were reflected separately but equally by West End bird baths, South Side beer cans, ghetto razors. In those days, Richmond was convoluted like the folds of the brain, as if, like the brain, it was attempting to prevent itself from knowing itself. In the evenings, the light from an ever-increasing number of television sets inflicted a misleading frostiness on the air. It has been said that true albinos produce light of a similar luminescence when they move their bowels. Middays, the city felt like the inside of a napalm watermelon. Whenever possible, men, women, children, and pets kept to the shade, talked little, stirred less, watched the blades of fans go round, as is the nature of fan business. Only Sissy Hankshaw voluntarily frequented those places where tar was sticky, where fried gravel sparkled, where weeds wilted, where asphalt crumbled, the devil's leftover birthday cake, where worn concrete translated into Braille long, bitter arguments between the organic and inorganic levels of life. If you have ever licked nickel or kissed steel, you know the arguments. Some say excessive sunshine softens the brain, repulsively soft already, and maybe that's what made her do it. Maybe it was the yellow gloves of hydrogen boxing her ears. Maybe solar radiation caused her atoms to whirl a trifle cuckoo. On the other hand, her action may have been merely an indication of the scope of her ambition, and while remarkable, should hardly be considered any more strange than little Mozart's impulse at age 9 to compose a symphony. In any case, and whichever the ever, upon a sweaty but otherwise nondescript afternoon in early August 1960, an afternoon squeezed out of Mickey's mousy snout, an afternoon carved from mashed potatoes and lye, an afternoon scraped out of the dog dish of meteorology, an afternoon that could lull a monster to sleep, an afternoon that normally might have produced nothing more significant than diaper rash, Sissy Hankshaw stepped from a busted jaw curbstone on Hull Street in South Richmond and attempted to hitchhike an ambulance. As a matter of fact, she tried to flag it down twice, coming and going. Squalling, its red lamps flashing as if in frenetic amateurish imitation of that summer's quietly professional sun, the ambulance was on an errand of mercy. Naturally, it did not stop. Had she expected it to? Would she have boarded it, joined its bleeding or gasping cargo if it had? Had she successfully hitchhiked an ambulance, would she not next have tried a hearse? Conjecture. The meat wagon rolled on, and Sissy, unlike young Mozart, was rewarded not so much as a lump of sugar for her experiment. However, the ambulance crew had not failed to notice her hailings. Before Sissy had gotten many blocks away, she was, for the first time in her career, arrested. Her appearance at the station house created a minor stir. On the one hand, the girl seemed pathetic. On the other, she was Buddha belly serene, and to the cop mentality, serenity smacks of disrespect. She was underage, her crime difficult to classify, the procedure uncertain. A police reporter from the News Leader became the first journalist to be intrigued by her. He telephoned a city editor to send over a photographer. File clerks were sneaking around corners to get a glimpse of her. Other prisoners were making remarks. Finally, the desk sergeant lectured her against interfering with emergency vehicles and had a policewoman hustle her home. The photographer arrived too late to get a picture, and the reporter was peeved. But for the others involved, a hasty release was ideal. The police got her out of their crew cuts. Sissy got back to work. Early that humid evening, as a roaring warehouse blaze sent the makings of a billion Pall Malls up in premature smoke, she was arrested again for trying to flag down a fire engine. This time she was booked and held for 24 hours at the juvenile detention center, although the authorities once more found it expedient to set her free. Not the least of the reasons for her release was the frustration she caused the fingerprinter.
Wow. I'm going to have to read that. I've never read that.
Yeah.
First poem I ever wrote.
First poem?
Wow.
When?
1981. July 8th, 1981.
Wow. Go for it.
When all is said and all is done, you never really were the one. But when I think of only you, I know that only this is true. I love you now, I love you dear, I always want you to have you near. Oh, hear my plea, please be my friend, and stay by me until the end. Yes, these are words which you must hear, for when with you I know no fear. And 'tis true, I fear to say, afraid that you will go away, that when all is said and all is done, you never really were the one.
No, I know someone who's 50 years older than you were then, whose are still at that level. That's really good for a first poem.
Yeah. How old?
17.
17, yeah. You gotta start somewhere, right? You might as well start with a love poem.
Same time period. 17. This is a poem I wrote a couple months ago. So it would be 81 to 2010.
Wait a minute. You wrote this poem recently, but it's about that time.
Yeah. Okay. So that's 81. 80,
29 years ago.
So I read you the poem from when I was 17, and this is a poem about being 17 from the perspective of being 30 years older. Ready?
Ready.
You brought this upon yourself.
I guess I did.
Yeah. It's called Memory and Prelude. I woke this morning, early, writhing, a dream's lingering claws, stroked, squeezed, and no more sleep. Not even close, what was it? Not a woman, known or stranger, nor man, animal, god. A memory, old one, released last night when I found a high school essay. In a pile, a glance, a nod, none else. But enough. A teacher I don't remember, but he liked me. Those years weren't pretty. He graded me high, smiled, taught me with a man's hope that someone listened. All I wanted to do was fuck a cheerleader. Or the poet girl I adored. Or quite a few others. No why in it. The rest of my grades made nobody proud. Nobody smile. Hope. I skipped school for the library to write a paper on my favorite books, the ones with no money and a laughing kindness for all. I wrote and wrote, then typed and typed. He smiled, hoped, gave me the best grade he could, but knew it wasn't good enough. I wanted to fuck her, and fuck her, and fuck her. Skip school, hid, read, wrote. Then one day came, and suddenly I remembered. This morning, no more sleep. I had a friend. His name was John. He was a rough piece of work. He liked me, too, and it mattered more. Here's why. One day he saw me getting pushed around and stepped in. I didn't have many friends, none like him. His act, his word, protected me. I didn't know how to fight anymore, then I knew how to fuck. Nobody had taught me. I knew how to hide, elude, get through the day, keep my thoughts my own, close. I don't know why he liked me, or stepped in. I had nothing to offer me. He could have taught me how to fight and fuck, maybe. I would return and ask, how do you do it? Use your body's power, its want, its will. Show me. Maybe he would have. What did I have for him? It was another day's answer, and maybe this is what wouldn't let me sleep this morning. What drove me from bedroom to living room couch. Is this a lesson, something like that? I don't think so. Or a lesson thus spoke. Shit happens. All the time. Maybe something else? Maybe something else. You see, he asked me a question, this friend, John, and I answered because I had no friends like him, and no cheerleader pussy, and no skills to fight, make way in the world. He was in the hallway, taking a makeup test in the class where I'd given the teacher hope. I came out to go to the bathroom and he asked me to help him. The teacher called it cheating later when he caught me. I suppose so. The teacher's heart broke and he crushed my grade down low. Probably my friend outright failed. I went to college and he probably didn't. We were different kinds of failures. I could contrive a sentence and write it out. He could beat up a fellow and then lay his cheerleader girlfriend out smooth, give it to her twice hard, make her moan, writhe, cheer, forget a while. And what was all this for? Maybe all these years later, I simply look back and wonder how little connection any of us made then, and how this not much truth is so often true. That hour, helping, cheating, hoping, breaking, it passed, passed long, long ago. Nobody left from it, just an old sheaf of typed papers I found yesterday, what was called onion skin back then. A grade scrawled over it, the dead bones of a gone pride. A breakable certainty in me about the world years back replaced by a working doubt. The universal flow collects it all, whatever its seeming worth.
I'm remembering now, and I have a terrible memory, but what the hell, I'll share this with you. This is, I think, one of the first poems I ever remember writing. And it's rhymed. I think sometimes when you start out writing, you rhyme it, because that's what you think poetry
is. You think, yeah, exactly.
And I wrote this when I was living in New York City. I lived at the time. So I'll probably stumble a bit on it. I don't think it had a title.
Oh, right.
I was 20, let me think. I was probably 24, I think. It's embarrassing. So was yours, I guess, for you to read. All right.
I had mine kept in my possession. Yeah, no, you're just trying to recall it from the ether.
You know, mine's apparently seared itself. Minutes, hours, days conspire to drag him screaming to the grave. So that's a poor Rick, right? Minutes, hours, days conspire to drag him screaming to the grave. Heart and mind and loins of fire. No cross to bear, no child to bathe. In the eyes of Adam, Eve, woman, lover, man's helpmeet, will there never be a one to share his flesh and soul complete? Mistress Grief, you are his love. 'Tis you alone that he adores. This is the killer now. Hope is such a steep old cliff, and sorrow such a pretty whore.
Oh my gosh!
Wow! Wow.
It's like Elizabethan or something. I don't know where that comes from.
Wow!
Poor young Rick, also.
Poor young Rick.
Banging his head on the wall in a cheap room in New York, coming up with.
I can recite most of them that I wrote when I was 15. It wasn't my first, but it was early. Totally blanked out now. Poetry is for but a hapless few, for whom thoughts and words are more meaningful than pleasure and sin, da 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 da, and for whom each and every journey into reality is more of a painful voyage, and they must scatter, and upon arrival they must scatter their thoughts like litter in the wind.
Ooh.
Very nice.